The customs officer I had seen in the office hurried out and said, "It's quite all right, sir, quite all right. His papers are in order." The senior official seemed to go black in the face with fury, and no one could get a word in. On his orders I was taken to a room where my cases were opened and everything thrown onto the floor. He found nothing wrong here. So he demanded my passport and other papers. I gave them to him and he leafed through them and then snarled that I had a visa and a work permit and I didn't need both. With that he tore my passport across and threw it in the garbage bin. Suddenly he stooped, picked up all the papers and crammed them in his pocket so that, I suppose, he could destroy them elsewhere. He rang a bell and two men came from the outer office. "This man has no papers," said the senior officer, "he will have to be deported." "But," said the officer who had stamped my papers, "I saw them, I stamped them myself." The senior turned to him enraged and said such things that made the poor man turn pale. And so eventually I was taken to a cell and left there. The next day a simpering young idiot from the Foreign Office came, stroked his baby face and agreed with me that I must have had the necessary papers. "But," he said, "the Foreign Office could not have trouble with the Immigration Office, so I would have to be sacrificed. The best thing I could do," he said, "would be to agree that my papers had been lost overboard, otherwise I should be lodged in prison for quite a time and after the end of my sentence I should still be deported." 2 years in prison was a thought that did not suit me at all. So I had to sign a paper saying that my passport had been lost at sea. "Now," said the young man, "you will be deported to New York." This was too much for me because I had left from Montreal and Quebec, but the answer was quick. I had to go to New York because if I went to the province of Quebec and told my story the press might get hold of it and make a commotion. Because the press were always avid for anything sensational, not from a point of view of doing anyone any good, but just because the press thrived and thrive on sensation and on trouble. I was kept in a cell one for a time, and then one day I was told I was to be deported the next day. In the morning I was led out of the cell and the senior officer was there beaming with joy that he, petty little bureaucrat that he was, had managed to subvert justice to his own wishes. In the afternoon I was taken to the ship, and told that I would have to do work, and it would be the hardest work aboard ship, Tremenco 01, in the bunkers of one of the oldest of old coal burners. Then I was taken back to the cell because the ship was not yet ready to leave and the captain could not accept me aboard until an hour before departure time. 24 hours later I was taken to the ship and locked in a very small cabin where I was kept until the ship sailed beyond territorial limits. After a time I was released from the cell, for that is what the small cabin was, and then given a battered shovel and rake and told to clean out the clinkers, etc. So I sailed back across the Atlantic, back toward New York, and as the first loom of land appeared in the morning the captain sent for me and spoke to me alone. He told me that he agreed I had been unjustly treated. He told me that the police were coming aboard to arrest me and I would be sentenced for illegal entry into the USA. And then after serving a sentence, I would be deported to China. He looked about him, and then went to a drawer in his desk saying, "A man like you can easily escape if you bar want to. The biggest difficulty is the handcuffs. Here is a key which will fit American handcuffs, I will turn away and you can take the key. As you can understand I cannot give you the key, but if you take it well, I need know nothing about it." So saying he turned, and I quickly pocketed the key. That captain was a very decent man indeed. As the US police came aboard checking their handcuffs, he told them that I was not likely to cause any trouble. He told them that in his own opinion I had done nothing wrong and I was just being framed by an unpleasant immigration officer. The senior policeman laughed cynically and said that he quite agreed, every man was being framed by someone else. And with that he snapped the handcuffs on my wrists and gave me a rough bunch toward the Jacob's ladder, the ladder by which pilots and policemen enter and leave ships still at sea. With some difficulty I managed to get down the ladder, although the police were expressing hopes that I would fall in and they would have to fish me out. Aboard the police launch I was roughly pushed down in the stern. Then the two policemen went about their job of filling in a report and turning their launch towards the shore. I waited my chance until the wolves were near, and then when the police were not looking in my direction I just jumped over the side. The water was dreadful. There was a thin scum of oil and filth on the surface, filth which was the sewage of the ships and liners docked there, filth which had blown off the wharves, floating newspapers, floating boxes, bits of coke, all manner of strange pieces of wood just floating by. I dived deep and managed to get hold of the key and unlock the handcuffs which I let drop to the bottom of the harbor. I had to come up for air, and as I broke surface there was a fuselage of shots quite close to me, so close that one of the bullets spattered water in my face. So, with a quick gulp of air, I sank down again and struck out not for the closest ward pilings, but one rather more distant, with the thought that the police would expect me to swim for the nearest. Slowly I let myself rise to the surface until only my mouth and chin were above water. Then again I took a deep breath, and another, and another. No shots came my way, but I could just barely see the police launch cruising about in front of the nearer wharf. Gently I let myself sink again and swam slowly to conserve my air supply to the wharf. There was a sudden bump, and instinctively my hands went out and clasped on that which I had bumped my head. It was a mess of half-sunken timbers which apparently had fallen from the partly ruined wharf above me. I clung to that with just my face out of the water. Slowly, as I could hear no sound, I sat up, and in the distance I could see the police launch which had been joined by two others prowling about beneath the piles of the other wharf. On top of the wharf armed police were dashing around searching various buildings. I kept still because suddenly a boat came along with three policemen in it. They were rowing silently. One of the policemen had a pair of binoculars and he was scrutinizing all the wharves in the area. Slowly I slid off the beam and let myself sink in the water so that only my nose and mouth were above the surface. Eventually I raised my head a bit and the boat was a long way away. As I looked I heard a shout, "Guess the guy's a stiff by now, we'll pick up his body later." I lay again on the beam shivering uncontrollably in the coldness of wet clothing and the stiff breeze which blew across me. When darkness was falling I managed to get onto the top of the wharf and darted for the shelter of a shed. A man was approaching and I saw he was a Lascar, and he looked quite friendly, so I gave a low whistle. He strolled nonchalantly on and, quite without purpose it seemed, he edged toward my hiding place. Then he stooped to pick up some pieces of paper which were lying about. "Come out cautious like," he said, "a colored gentleman is waiting with a truck. He'll get you out of this." Well, eventually I did get out of it, but I was in a sorry state indeed. I was suffering from exhaustion and from exposure. I got into the garbage truck, a tarpaulin stretched over me, and a whole load of garbage dumped on top. The colored man took me to his home and I was well looked after, but for 2 days and nights I slept the sleep of the totally exhausted. During my exhaustion, while the physical body was repairing itself, I made an astral journey and saw my beloved guide and friend, the Lama Minyadondup. He said to me, "Your sufferings have truly been great, too great. Your sufferings have been the sour fruit of man's inhumanity to man, but your body is getting worn out and soon you will have to undergo the ceremony of transmigration." In the astral world I sat and my companion sat with me. I was told more. "Your present body is in a state of collapse. The life of that body will not continue much longer. We feared that such conditions would prevail in the wild western world that you would be impaired, and so we have been looking about for a body which you could take over and which in time would reproduce all your own features. We have determined that there is such a person. His body is on a very, very low harmonic of your own, otherwise, of course, a change could not take place. The bodies must be compatible. And this person has a body which is compatible. We have approached him in the astral because we saw that he contemplated suicide. It is a young Englishman who is very, very dissatisfied with life. He is not at all happy with life, and for some time he has been trying to decide on the most painless method of what he calls self-destruction. He is perfectly willing to leave his body and journey here to the astral world provided he doesn't lose by it. We persuaded him a little time ago to change his name to that which you are now using, so there are a few more things to be settled and then, well, You will have to change bodies. It was very, very necessary. I was instructed that I should return to Tibet before I could undergo the necessary process of transmigration. Careful instructions were given to me, and when I felt well enough I went to a shipping office and took passage to Bombay. Once again was subjected to all manner of harassment because my luggage consisted of just one case. But at last I got aboard the ship, and when I was in my cabin two detectives came to visit me to find out why I had only one case. Assured that I had adequate luggage in India, they smiled happily and went away. It was most strange being a passenger aboard ship. Everyone avoided me because I was a pariah who had only one case of luggage. The others, of course, seemed to have enough luggages to stock a whole store, but I, apparently the poorest of the poor, must be a fugitive from justice, or something, to travel as I did, and so I was avoided. The ship went from New York all the way up along the coast of Africa and through the Straits of Gibraltar. Then we made another stop at Alexandria before entering the Suez Canal, and so on to the Red Sea. The Red Sea was terrible, the heat was murderous, and I almost got heat stroke. But finally we passed the coast of Ethiopia, crossed the Arabian Sea, and docked at Bombay. The noise and smell in Bombay was terrible, fantastic in fact, but I had a few friends, a Buddhist priest and a few influential people, and so my week's stay in Bombay was made interesting. After the week in which I tried to recover from all the shocks and strains I had had, I was put on a train and crossed India to the city of Kalimpong. I managed to drop off the train before it actually entered Kalimpong because I had been warned that the place was absolutely thronged with communist spies and newspaper men, and new arrivals were stopped and questioned by newspaper men, and as I found to be true later, if one would not give an interview the newspaper men invented one without any regard whatever to the truth. I knew Kalimpong slightly, certainly I knew enough to get in touch with some friends, and so went underground away from spies and away from newspaper men. By now my health was deteriorating very rapidly, and there were serious fears that I could not live long enough to undergo the ceremony of transmigration. A lama who had been trained at Chakpurai with me was in Kalimpong, and he came to my assistance with very potent herbs. I moved on in the company of this medical lama, and after 10 weeks of hard travel we reached a lamasery overlooking the valley of Lhasa. It was high and inaccessible, it was inconspicuous, and communists would not bother about such a small insignificant place. Here again I rested for some 7 days in all. On the morrow, I was told one day, I should journey into the astral and meet the astral body of the man whose physical vehicle I was going to take over. For the present I rested, and mused upon the problems of transmigration. This person's body was not of much use to me because it was his body and had a lot of vibrations incompatible with my own. In time, I was told, the body would conform exactly to my own body when at that same age, and if Westerners find this a difficult matter to believe or understand, let me put it like this: the Western world knows about electroplating, and the Western world also knows about electrotyping. In the latter system, an article can be immersed in a certain fluid and a special connector is applied opposite the article, and when current is turned on at the correct rate and amperage, an exact duplicate of the original item is built up. This is known as electrotyping. Again, it is possible to do electroplating. One can plate in a variety of metals: nickel, chromium, rhodium, copper, silver, gold, platinum, etc. One merely has to know how to do it. But the current flows from one pole to another through a liquid, and the molecules of one pole are transferred to the other pole. It is a simple enough system, but this is not a treatise on electroplating. Transmigration and the replacing molecule by molecule of the fabric of the host by that of the, what shall I say, new occupant is very real. It has been done time after time by those who know how. Fortunately, those who know how have always been people of reliable character. Otherwise it would be a terrible thing indeed if one did just take over another person's body and do harm. I felt rather smug, foolishly so perhaps, when I thought that, well, I am going to do good, I don't want to take over anyone else's silly body, all I want is peace. But it seemed there was to be no peace in my life. In passing, and as one who has studied all religions, I must point out that adepts did it for life after life. The Dalai Lama himself had done so, and the body of Jesus was taken over by the Spirit of the Son of God, and it had been common knowledge even in the Christian belief until it was banned because it made people too complacent. From my high viewpoint in this remote isolated Lamasery, I could look out upon the distant city of Lhasa. Quite a powerful telescope had somehow been smuggled out of the Potala and brought here, so one of my idle amusements was to use the telescope and look at the surly Chinese guards at the Pagokling. I saw the troops rushing about in their jeeps. I saw through that telescope many unspeakable things done to men and to women, and I recalled with great horror that I had fought on the side of the Chinese as had many others, and now the Chinese were not behaving according to their promises, according to their avowed principles. All they thought of was violence. It was hard to believe, looking out of the glassless window, that this was the same Tibet, the same Lhasa, that I had known before. Here the golden sun still struck gleaming rays through ravines in the mountains, the silvery moon still traversed the blackness of the night sky, and the distant pinpoints of colored light which were the stars still stabbed down through the roof of heaven. Nightbirds did not call, though, as of yore because the Chinese communists killed everything on sight. To my horror I found that they were extinguishing the life of those creatures I loved so much. Birds, they say, ate the grain which would cause humans to starve. Cats were killed, so no longer, so I was told, were there any cats left in Lhasa. Dogs were killed and eaten by the Chinese. It seemed to be a Chinese delicacy. So not only poor humans are being subjected to death at the hands of the Chinese communists, animals too, the pets of gods, were being exterminated for no worthwhile reason. I was sick at heart at all the horrors being perpetrated on a harmless, innocent people. As I gazed out at the darkening sky, I was overcome with emotion, overcome with sorrow, and then I thought, well, I have this job to do, much evil has been forecast in my life. I hope I am strong enough to endure all that which has been foretold. For some time I had been dimly aware of much excitement, of an air of expectancy, and my attention had been drawn again and again to Lhasa. The telescope was wonderful. But it was difficult looking out through a slit window with such a cumbersome article, so I turned to a pair of 20 magnification binoculars which also had been brought and which offered greater maneuverability for views beyond the angle of the telescope in the window. My attention was suddenly distracted from looking out, for three men entered, two of them supporting the one between them. I turned and looked at him in horror. He was blind, his eyes had been gouged out leaving red pools. His nose was missing. The two men with him gently helped him to a sitting position, and in fascinated horror I recognized him as one that I had known before, as one who had helped me with my studies at Chakpori. The two attendants bowed and left. The Lama and I were facing each other, and he spoke in a low voice, "My brother," he said to me, "I can well discern your thoughts. You wonder how I got in a condition like this. I will tell you. I was out about my lawful occasion and I happened to glance up toward Iron Mountain. A Chinese communist officer suddenly turned from where he was sitting in his car and accused me of staring at him and thinking evil thoughts towards him. Naturally, I denied the charge, for such was not the truth. I was merely looking at our beloved home. All priests were liars and reactionists, and he gave abrupt orders to his men. I was seized and knocked down, and then a rope was put around my chest and knotted behind my back. The other end was tied to the rear of the car in which the officer sat. Then, with a whoop of joy, he drove off dragging me face down on the road. The old Lama stopped and lifted his robe. I gasped with horror because all the skin and much of the flesh had been torn off from head to foot, shreds of flesh hung down, and the inside of his robe was just a bloody mess. He carefully lowered his robe again, and said, "Yes, the roughness of the road tore off my nose, it tore off other things too, and now I am waiting to pass over to the land beyond. But before I can have that release, I have one more task to do." He paused for a moment or two, getting back some energy, and then said, "This matter of transmigration and the possibility that we might have to use it has been known for many years, and I was in charge of the project. I had to study the ancient manuscripts to find out as much as I could about it. I had to consult the Akashic records and I had to amass as much knowledge as I could. He paused again, but then went on, the Chinese eventually released me from my bonds, but the officer had one more evil deed to do. He kicked me as I lay on my back in the dirt and said, "You stared at me and you wished me evil, for that you shall stare no more." One of his men picked up a sharp narrow flint from the roadway and stuck it in my eyeballs, one after the other, and just flipped my eyeballs out so that they dangled on my cheeks. Then with a laugh they went away and left me as I was, with my nose ripped off, my body ripped and torn. No longer would one be able to say if I was a man or a woman because such parts had been torn off, and on my cheeks rested my blinded eyes with the orbs perforated and the fluid spilling out and running down to my ears. When they were able to, shocked people came to my aid and I was lifted up and carried into a house. I fainted, and when I recovered consciousness I found that my eyes had been removed and I had been well treated with herbal packs. Stealthily by night I was carried up into the mountains to await your coming. Now I have to telephone one you much, and to accompany you into a journey into the astral from which I shall not return. He rested yet a while that he might regain a little of his strength, and then when a slight color was returning to his cheeks he said, "We must go into the astral." So we went the familiar route again. Each of us was sitting in the lotus position, that position which we of the East find the easiest to maintain. We said our suitable mantras with which our vibrations were so heightened that with the almost imperceptible jerk which accompanies such transition we departed from our bodies, I temporarily and my companion permanently. The greyness of earth and the white of the eternal snows departed from our sight. Before us there appeared a veil which shimmered bluish-white, a veil which as one first approached it appeared to be an impenetrable barrier, but those who knew how could enter without hindrance. This we did, and found ourselves in an area of glorious light with impressions of joy. At that point of the astral world which we entered we were upon a green sward, the grass was short and springy beneath our feet. "Ah!" breathed the Lama with me, "how wonderful to see again, how wonderful to be without pain. Soon my task will be finished, then I shall be home for a time at least." So saying he led me along a pleasant path. There were trees about, many, many trees, all in green and red and yellow leaf. To the side of us there swept a majestic river, mirroring in its watery surface the deep blue of the sky above. Faint fleecy clouds drifted lazily across the sky and there was an atmosphere of bubbling life, of vitality, of health, of happiness. In the trees birds sang, birds of a type which I had not seen on earth, for these were glorious creatures indeed, birds of many different colors, birds of many different plumage. The old man and I walked on among the trees, and then we came to an open space which was indeed a garden of brilliant flowers, none of a type that could be recognized by me. The flowers seemed to nod toward us as if greeting us. In the distance I could see people wandering about as if they were luxuriating in this glorious garden. Every so often a person would bend and sniff a flower. At times others would reach up skywards, and a bird would come and land on his outstretched hand. There was no fear here, only peace and contentment. We walked on a while, and then before us we saw what seemed to be an immense temple. It had a cupola of shining gold and the walls which supported it were of a light fawn color. Other buildings stretched away from it, each in a pastel shade, all in harmony, but at the entrance to the temple a group of people were waiting. Some of them wore the robes of Tibet, and another I could not understand what he was wearing for the moment. It looked as if he was wearing black or something very dark. And then I saw as we approached that it was a man of the Western world attired in Western raiment. At our approach the lamas turned and spread their hands in our direction, spread their hands in welcome. I saw that one of them was my guide and friend. The Lama Minya donned up, so I knew that all would be well, for this man was good and good only. Another figure I saw was even more eminent when upon the earthly plane, but now he was just one of the welcoming committee awaiting us. Our happy greetings were soon exchanged, and then as one we moved into the body of the great temple, traversing the central hall and moving further into that building. We entered a small room, the existence of which was not easy to discern. It appeared as if the walls slid away and, admitting us to its presence, closed solidly behind us. My guide, obviously the spokesman, turned to me and said, "My brother, here is the young man whose body you are going to inhabit." I turned and faced the young man aghast. Certainly there was no resemblance at all between us. He was much smaller than I, and the only resemblance between us was that he was bald the same as I. My guide laughed at me and shook an admonitory finger at my nose. Now, Lobsang," he laughed, "not so quick with your decisions. All this has been planned. First I am going to show you some pictures from the Akashic Record." And this he did. Upon completing our viewing of the records, he said, addressing the young man, "Now young man, I think it is time that you told us something about yourself, for if one is to take over your body, then it certainly is time for the one taking over to know that with which he is faced." The young man, so addressed, looked very truculent indeed and replied in sullen tones, "Well, no, I have nothing to say about my past. It has always been held against me. Whatever I do say about my past, it will only be used to pull me down." My guide looked sadly at him and said, "Young man, we here have vast experience of these things, and we do not judge a man by what his parentage is alleged to be, but what that man is himself." My guide sighed and then said, "You were going to commit the mortal sin of suicide, a sin indeed, a sin which could have cost you dear in many, many lives of hardship to atone. We offer you peace, peace in the astral, so that you may gain understanding of some of those things which have troubled you throughout your life. The more you cooperate, the more easily can we help you, as well as helping the task which we have before us." The young man shook his head in negation, and said, "No. The agreement was that I wanted to leave my body, you wanted to stuff someone else in it, that's all the agreement was, I hold you to it." Suddenly there was a flash and the young man disappeared. The old Lama with me, who was now a young man full health, exclaimed, "Oh dear, dear, with such truculent thoughts he could not stay with us here on this astral plane. Now we shall have to go to where he is sleeping in a room alone. But for this night we must let him sleep, we do not want to injure the body, so I shall have to return somehow to Lhasa with you until the next night." Time passed, and I could see that the old Lama was failing rapidly, so I said to him, "Time we went into the astral." "Yes," he replied, "I shall not see this body of mine again. I must go, we must go, for if I die before I am in the astral it will delay us." Together we encountered that jerk and soared on and upwards, but not into the astral world we had visited before. This time we soared across the world to a house in England. We saw in the physical the face of the man whom I had previously seen only in the astral. He looked so discontented, so unhappy. We tried to attract his attention, but he was sleeping very soundly indeed. The old Lama whispered, "Are you coming?" I whispered, "Are you coming?" And we kept it up, first one and then the other, until at last very, very reluctantly the astral form of this man emerged from his physical body. Slowly it oozed out. Slowly it coalesced above him in the exact shape of his body, and then it reversed its position, head of the astral body to the feet. The form tilted and landed on his feet. He certainly looked very truculent and, I could see, he had absolutely no recollection of seeing us before. This was astounding to me, but my companion whispered that he had been in such a bad temper and had slammed back in his body so violently that he had completely obliterated all memories of what had happened to him. "So you want to leave your body?" I asked. "I most certainly do," he almost snarled back at me. "I absolutely hate it here." I looked at him and I shuddered with apprehension and, not to put too fine a point upon it, with pure fright. How was I going to take over the body of a man like this? Such a truculent man, so difficult. But, there it was. He laughed and said, "So you want my body? Well, it doesn't matter what you want, it doesn't matter who you are in England, all that matters is who do you know. How much have you got?" We talked to him for a time and he grew calmer and I said, "Well, one thing, you will have to grow a beard." "I cannot shave my beard because my jaws have been damaged by the Japanese." "Can you grow a beard?" Yes, sir, he replied, I can and I will. I thought for a moment and then I said, very well, you should be able to grow a suitable beard in a month.